Hi, this is Alex Roman, Managing Editor for Metro Magazine, and welcome to Metrospectives, a podcast about public transportation, the private motor coach industry, and all things mobility. Today, my guest is Scott Bogren, Executive Director for the CTAA. I get a chance to talk to Scott about the impact COVID-19 is having on his membership, as well as look forward to what a transportation authorization bill may look like. And now, my conversation with Scott.
Welcome to Metrospectives. I'm Alex Roman, Managing Editor for Metro Magazine. My guest today is Scott Bogren, Executive Director of the Community Transportation Association of America, or CTAA. Mr. Bogren, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here, Alex. Thanks. Look forward to the conversation.
Great. I wanted to get started with just a little background on the CTAA. If you could talk a little bit about your membership and the type of operations you represent.
Sure. Community Transportation Association, or CTAA, is a little over 30 years old. We are a national nonprofit organization. We've got about 1,400 members representing between 1,000 and 1,100 agencies. Some agencies have multiple members. Our operators, who are really the focus and the core of our membership, fall into rural transit operators, small city transit operators. Small city for us is 50,000 to 200,000 population. We also represent a lot of non-emergency medical transportation providers, specialized systems that are serving older adults and people with disabilities, tribal communities, veterans. We have a number of members that are volunteer driver oriented and use all volunteers to do their services. We also work directly with all 50 state DOTs because most of our members, their federal funds are all state managed. So we work with the DOT's transit divisions, state transit associations, and obviously the vendor community as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I guess, with everything going on right now with COVID-19, I think maybe a good place to start is to, talk a little bit about what CTAA has been doing for its members. How have you responded to this and how have you helped them kind of, stay operating or kind of deal with this crisis?
Well, as a DC-based organization and with the wrangling going on Capitol Hill over a significant emergency supplemental appropriations process, part of our work has been to make sure that the losses and damage to our members is included in the supplemental package. So we've been looking to quantify as best we can fare box loss, contract service loss, expenses when it comes to cleaning equipment and personal protective equipment and overtime for employees to clean the vehicles and all the things that are going on. We've been trying to convey that to members of Congress and work with the Federal Transit Administration similarly to make sure that the reality of operations for our members within this crisis are managed, because this is a game changer in a lot of ways. And I think further, a lot of our members operate kind of dial-a-ride, paratransit, demand response type systems, and trying to make sure that as the nation and its policymaking around response pivots to a lot of people staying home, sometimes by state order, the ability to deliver meals, to deliver medications, that we think some of our members are well placed and have the assets and the networks to do some of that in concert with public health officials. So we're also trying to work our folks who gratefully want to be part of the solution into that part of this as well.
That's interesting. So that kind of work, it's already going on in some cities?
Definitely. I mean, first off, you've got a lot of trips for that are really life-sustaining that are done in the NEMT phase, trips to dialysis, to chemotherapy. Those have to continue amidst this crisis. Otherwise, those folks are ending up in the hospital, which is where we don't want them.
Right.
Within the last 10 days, we've had a number of smaller city and local hospitals, rural hospitals, trying to discharge as many people in patients as they can to prepare for increased volume of patients with coronavirus. And so we've been, a lot of our members have been working to do that where it's a non-emergency type of trip. I think there are a lot of opportunities for those trips and that kind of service to happen. It's just so many questions, obviously, that everyone's working through in terms of what's the proper protective equipment for a driver. How do we make sure that both the passengers and the system's employees remain safe and healthy?
Right. And I would assume that they're working with the local hospitals and authorities in that area in that response?
Yeah, public health, working with health departments at state levels. I had some interesting conversations earlier today with a couple of members who've had drivers test positive and what that meant and how they had to react to that. And we are using what we're learning to communicate with all of our members about best practices and how to get ready, because unfortunately, it's likely that more of our members and agencies are going to experience that. How do we prepare them for reaching out with health officials and all the other things that a positive test entails?
Right. Interesting. And so kind of, I got to imagine this is something that you've never really had to deal with before as an association, at least on this kind of a level. Am I correct?
No. I'd like to tell you that we are very prescient and we plan everything and we're ready for anything, but this is so kind of extraordinary and unprecedented. We have a member who has done a lot of non-emergency medical transportation. We often kind of point to them as the original.
Right.
In the NEMT space, they're up in Rochester, New York, and they were founded in response to the 1919 flu epidemic.
Oh, wow.
And we would always kind of refer to that as some sort of like ancient history. And I thought about that the other day and thought, my gosh, we're living that now.
Wow, that's incredible. And there are other issues. I know that they're kind of pressing. Really, the pressing issue is getting through this as a nation. But this is also sitting to be a big year for public transit as far as reauthorization goes. What kind of goals from the constituents that you have? What kind of goals are you trying to get into a bill? How are you working with congressional members and everyone you need to kind of get that message across?
Well, we're actively working with Congress and committee staff. We testified, I guess it's about a month or so ago. It seems like a year ago now. We testified in front of the Senate Banking Committee, which was the first hearing on the Senate side. We've worked really closely with House committee staff, T&I committee staff. Our goals are pretty much what you'd expect. I mean, within the formula programs, we want to see growth. sustainable, consistent growth that our members can kind of budget multiple years out, that's predictable, that isn't something that has to be actively fought through each appropriation cycle, but that's something that can be kind of budgeted for. And for us, those are, to get into the weeds, those are things like 5307, 5311, 5310, and 5339. Those four sections of the code are the places where we're looking. In addition to that, which I think anybody in our place is going to answer that question that way, but in addition to that, we're looking to develop some new federal funding programs that start to weave together NEMT and public transit, so that public transit, frankly, can be viewed in a more positive light because of the healthcare outcomes that many of our members, as public transit agencies, are creating.
Right.
And that the healthcare sector, whether it's the HHS or the CMS, which funds Medicaid and Medicare, these are massive federal programs, much bigger than our little slice of the surface transportation piece. And we're delivering results. We, meaning CTA's members and others, are delivering positive results. We need those systems that are benefiting those to invest in these transit systems. So we want to see some programs that look at that. Obviously, in today's age, weaving together kind of the different technological approaches to providing mobility, whether it's app based or whether you're deploying integrated fare models, or whether you're looking at TNC style mobility on demand approaches. We think all of those also need to be woven together into a different kind of funding program, or something that incentivizes systems to look into those approaches, because those are the approaches that the riding public want.
Right.
And so you know, it's like anything else. I think we need to have options from a mobility perspective, and we can no longer afford as a country to kind of have the public transit option being the same system that was put together in a fixed route way and put on the streets 30 years ago.
Right.
Some of those fixed routes make perfect sense today. And from a data-driven analytics perspective, we can prove that. A lot of those may not be fruitful or productive routes. And in those cases, there are still people in those areas that need to be served. How do we put together different styles of service to meet that need?
Right. You know, out in the larger cities, I feel like they've been pretty adaptive into creating microtransit and these sorts of programs that have fit, some have not. With calling the smaller communities and the smaller cities, are you seeing that same kind of nimbleness with adaptability?
Yeah, it's interesting. You're right. I mean, if you're in, Taylor and I live and work here in the D.C. area, you're in New York City, Chicago, L.A., you can really put together an approach like the one you referred to and just kind of throw that out to the general public. What we find in the smaller communities is it needs to be kind of purpose-driven. So you need to kind of connect that approach with an outcome that you're trying to create. And it, you know, that outcome could be in a small community, better access to opioid treatment and recovery.
Right.
Okay. Or it could be we're engaged in a program in Oklahoma City, which is not such a small city, to improve results in the foster care system. And in those smaller cases, in those kind of purpose outcome-based approaches, what we think should happen is you should be able to have a much more clean understanding of an economic benefit that's created. To use the foster care system approach, well, if we reduce the number of children in foster care, certainly the amount of time that a child is placed in foster care, if we reduce the amount of time that it takes a court-involved parent to get through the different systems that they are required to get through so they can be reunited with their child, if we can make that happen quicker and more efficiently, we're saving the foster care system money.
Right.
The ultimate goal then is that the foster care system takes a piece of what it was spending and invests in this transportation engine that's been created to create that outcome. And what we try to work with smaller communities is to kind of have them approach different issues that are specific in their community and say, but for a more innovative transportation approach, could we get a better outcome?
Right.
So, and then the other thing in smaller communities, as opposed to the larger ones, is you can get things done quicker. There are far fewer layers of bureaucracy. And so if you can get a community to adapt to adopt an approach and kind of look at it, then boom, they can move quickly.
Right. So I'd imagine maybe the hardest thing from their end would be coming up with the funding or, you know, forging the partnership and finding that trust to make the program work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in most smaller communities don't have the kind of local taxes that big cities have that are obviously funding and underpinning massive transit networks. State funding is hit or miss depending on the state, and also is kind of subject to the whims of a lot of state legislative processes. So yeah, you're right. That part can be one of the trickiest pieces.
Right. And going back to the authorization, it's always kind of a sticking point of when this gets started, how it gets started, and most importantly, I guess, how it's funded. I know, current circumstances aside, there seemed to be a desire to get an authorization bill done for public transit, for transportation in general. Is that the sense that you got as the process was beginning?
I think, like, at the surface level, everyone, and I use that word everyone very loosely, but the advocacy organizations, congressional offices that are on the right committees, everyone agrees we need to do this. And that the ability to move people around the country cost effectively, safely, and increasingly with as light a touch as possible on the environment, that all makes sense. But that has made sense for 15 or 20 years, yet we've been unable to break through the log jam on how do we pay for it.
Right.
And I've worked a number of reauthorizations, 5 or 6 of them in my 30 years at CTAA. We are just beginning the process here of the current one. And like several of the more recent versions, we have authorizing committees that are moving down the road, conceptualizing ideas, good ones, and I think writing good policy.
Right.
But none of that can happen unless the money is there. And that part is just, for a lot of reasons, it's just been really tough to tackle. And it's why, from a timing standpoint, though everyone wants to see this, I don't expect that we'll see anything until about this time next year.
Right.
Because, I mean, the election, before the virus, before the pandemic, there was pretty widespread agreement, even among those in the know on the Hill, that we're throwing markers down right now with ideas, and that largely they'll be ignored through the election. You'll get a lame duck Congress in November and December that may take things up depending on how the partisanship and parties settle out. And then, you know, late January, you'll have an administration seated for 4 years. You'll have a new Congress. And like, I think the clock really starts then.
Right.
On can you get something done on this, and answering the question that is the central one: how do we pay for increased investments in surface transportation that everyone agrees are necessary?
Right. Well, great. On that, I think we'll end there. Scott, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Happy to do so. You know, if we can at CTA with your listeners and your readers, if anybody, go to cta.org. We're eager to chat about any of these issues because we do feel they're really important right now. And you know, the current reaction to the pandemic and our role in trying to keep people safe and healthy is really foremost on all of our minds right now.
Right. Well, great. Thank you again for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks for listening to Metrospectives, a podcast from Metro Magazine. Be sure to check out all the latest industry news at metromagazine.com and follow us on Twitter @MetroMagTweet.